Well, well, welcome back, Boneheads. It's been a little while since we last spoke. Sorry about that. My bad. Ish. Kind of everyone's had everything come up, so that's not been great. However, we're here now, and we'll be back in 2 weeks, definitely, because we've got that all recorded. And then we are projecting that it will take a month to get the finale out. In the meantime, here is an episode I hope you enjoy, and I'm sorry again about the radio silence, or I guess RSS feed silence. Content warnings for this episode include cults, violence, murder, cannibalism, and the Merseyside. Oh, the Merseyside.
The following is a transcript retrieved from the hand of a bullet-riddled corpse and later delivered to me from the library's archives. The account details the descent into anarchy of Southport, as well as the establishment and subsequent disbanding of the Raiders, a cult following a leader deemed perfect, which was first formed in Southport. The transcript begins... 100. The perfect number. The perfect score. Unattainable. Unrealistic. Unreachable. It was impossible. We knew it was impossible, but he told us he had a score of 100, and we believed him. Or at least we pretended to. It's nice to have hope sometimes. Even if it's fake. False hope is easy, especially nowadays, now the world's ended, dead, whatever it is. It's so much easier to identify the good things, the things that can give you hope. It's so much harder to tell when it's useless, when it's fake, even when you know it is. Because when the world, when your life has become this unreal, it's near impossible to tell which of your thoughts and feelings are true. It's near impossible to distinguish between what you really believe, what you're really feeling, and what you just want to feel. So if you start feeling hope, you find yourself wanting to cling to that. So we did. Before he found us, we were nothing, had nothing, and wanted nothing. Our towns were empty and lawless. Most people had already moved into the cities, thought they'd have a better chance of survival there. Maybe they were right. Maybe we were stupid to stay behind. But either way, they deserted us, leaving 100 ghost towns in their wake. They left behind their pets, they left behind their food. They left behind their lives. And all that was left was this corpse of a town. But we were still there. We were still there to witness the decline. To witness the death of our homes. We watched as the supermarket shelves filled with sludge and dirt and mold. It was food once, but there were too few of us, so it went to waste. We watched it rot like the rest of the town, and we mourned. Gardens overgrew into the homes they once protected, reclaiming the land that we had stolen decades before. Pets became strays, and children got left behind. Our homes became houses. Those houses became shells, became dust. And the eye was always there. Omnipresent, watching us. And everything was awful. It only got worse from there. There was no one left to restore order, and none of us were keen to take on that role. And so what was once civilization crumbled into messy, violent chaos. crops had withered, then died, then returned to the earth, and nobody had planted any more in their place. We fought over the little food we had left, and the fights were bloody. I can still see it now. The image as clear as day, seared into my mind. A collage of ripped flesh, gaping wounds, blood-soaked hands. It became a regular occurrence. People who were once friends, fighting tooth and nail over any scraps of food they could find. Another week, another gory mess. Eventually, we ran out of food, ran out of things that weren't strictly food, but were technically edible, ran out of options altogether, except... What came next was pretty much unavoidable. Is it bad that I can't remember who we ate first? Does that make me a bad person? Does it make it worse that I can't remember if they volunteered themselves, if they agreed to it at all, or if we just cornered them and started chomping down? What followed was 4 weeks of rampant violence and cannibalism. 4 weeks. Almost a whole month. Bones and flesh, previously inseparable, inviolable, now rent, torn, masticated, and swallowed for the good of the ever-shrinking community. And then, he turned up. Arnold McGrath. And he told us we could be saved. I think I laughed when he first said that. And to be honest, I think I was right to laugh. I mean, here we were. A town full of cannibals and murderers, and this stranger, this outsider, turned up out of nowhere and gave a speech about how it wasn't over for us. I was right to laugh. He spoke to us like we were good, like we were clean, like we were people. And none of us had felt like people for a very long time. He spoke as if he didn't see the bodies in the streets and in our kitchens or the blood on our hands. As if he hadn't had to kick a pile of human bones out of the way to get into the town. And he told us that we could get better, that we could be good again. And we all individually decided that good old Arnold was the closest thing to a miracle we were going to get. So we decided to follow him, and we became the Raiders. His Raiders. Some called us a gang. Some called us a cult. Personally, I think we were a community. A group of desperate, broken people putting blind faith in the first source of hope we could find. And Arnold McGrath, the man who claimed to have a perfect score, seemed like a perfect candidate for our worship. He told us that he expected good from all of us, that he expected every single one of us to be the best possible version of themselves, the best, most pure, good, and kind person they were capable of being. There were many, many different interpretations of that instruction. Some took it as an instruction to only do good, to never do wrong, to try and cleanse themselves of whatever past sins they had committed, which, to be honest, was probably how Arnold actually meant for it to be interpreted. Others took it as an instruction to do as much good as they personally could. So, for a person who had become accustomed to murder and cannibalism, that simply meant they tried to kill and eat a few less people than before. Not that they gave up on their lifestyle completely. They still partook in hurting people, but they claimed it as a personal improvement. They'd gone from killing 3 people a day to only killing 1. And that was the best they could do. Some, though I'm sure they were the minority, took it as an instruction to do whatever they liked in their own time, as long as they made sure they behaved while in the presence of Arnold McGrath. Needless to say, there wasn't much moral improvement in our little community. We traveled. We avoided the cities, avoided those better off than us, those who hadn't resorted to violence the same way we had. Instead, we preyed on those we knew would believe us, those we knew would follow us. We specifically chose to recruit strangers from towns that had met similar fates to our own. We knew they would believe us because, in a way, they were us. We preached to them, told them about how we used to be like them, how we used to be monsters, ruffians, criminals, how Arnold McGrath rescued us from our sins and elevated us to a state of morality we never could have imagined. It was largely fabricated, of course. But what is hope, if not sugar-coated half-truths and sickly sweet lies? Our numbers grew and grew and grew until we were 300 strong, all blindly following Arnold McGrath anywhere he took us, believing that if we followed him, if we did everything he said, if we tried our best to match his definition of good, we could make better lives for ourselves. We soon discovered that wasn't true at all. As we traveled town to town, we just saw more and more bloodshed. As we looked down upon the cannibalistic townsfolk, we locked eyes with our pasts. And we realized that we weren't that much better off than we had been back then. We still had no food. We were still orphans and widows. Our lives were still scarred by the tragedy and torment of our pasts. Arnold hadn't given us salvation. He had just given us something to believe in. And the majority of us weren't as devout as he thought we were. We watched as he welcomed more barbarians into our community, and the braver ones among us began to think. They began to think, if he happily accepts murderers with open arms, hoping that they'll change, would he really feel that bad about having a few in our midst? Of course, there were those in our circle who had never stopped killing. Some had never given up their cannibalistic ways, having grown accustomed to the taste of human flesh long before Arnold took them under his wing, and weren't quite ready to give it up. Those among us whose violent tendencies remained started getting more bold. They no longer hid their depravity from Arnold McGrath. They started acting out in front of him. And they faced no consequences. And those who had previously been of the opinion that us and the Raiders had to behave, had to be good, pure, as virtuous as we could be, quickly changed their opinion. Soon enough, we broke back out into unbridled, unconstrained violence. We punched, kicked, bit each other, tore each other's flesh, chewed bits off and spat it back in the victim's face. Even the more gentle of the group became aggressive. Herd mentality, that's what it was. We all fall victim to it eventually. Pain. Death. Decay. The scent of blood and rot and ruin filled the air once again. And we were savages. Just like we'd been before. We fought and killed and fed like the hunters, the raiders that we were. We were unbridled, unrestrained by the so-called rule of law, by whatever Arnold had wanted for us. We were raw, primal, exactly who we truly were. Arnold finally stepped in when he realized how many of us were dying. But he'd left it too long, and we grew tired of him. I watched him die. I didn't intervene when they hurtled toward him, shredding his flesh, crushing his bones, letting his blood nourish the long dead grass. I think they probably ate him. I didn't stay long enough to find out. I saw other people fleeing in shock, their idol dead, nothing left to believe in. And I ran. I'm glad I left. Who knows what would have happened to me if I'd stayed. So, now I'm here, in this old, abandoned house, writing this account. Trying to get it all out while it's still fresh in my mind. Waiting for the raiders to find me and do what they will. What they do best. I don't know why, but I felt the need to write it down. Maybe someone will find it useful. Or at least entertaining. I hope my last words are a good read. Looking back, I'm not sure how many of us truly believed that he had a score of 100. I heard plenty of different opinions while I was with the Raiders. The ones who wholeheartedly believed that he was telling the full truth, they were a minority. There were countless other ideas floating around, though. Maybe he was lying about everything. Maybe he had a score of, say, 99 and was rounding up. Just flawed enough to lie. Maybe he had a score of 100, but that wasn't the maximum a person could achieve. Personally, I don't think it matters whether or not he was lying. I don't think it matters if he had a score of 100 or a perfect score or whatever you want to call it. We are human, and as humans, we're inherently imperfect, flawed by design. I don't think there's such a thing as a perfect score. And if there is, I don't think it's possible for a human to achieve it. As a species, we are rife with flaws, faults, and imperfections. We're forever tasked with carrying the burden of our sins, the burden of the crimes we witnessed but did not stop, and the wrongdoings of our ancestors. Bloodshed, oppression, colonialism. Historically, humanity has been nothing but corrupt. And though there are those of us who do enormous amounts of good, there will always be others that drag them down, prevent them from being the best they can be. Even the kindest person in the world has their faults. We all have moments in which we slip. An otherwise caring mother might have that one bad day where she raises her voice at her child, says something she will come to regret. A once innocent worker might take a new job in an effort to provide for their family, and they might keep taking new jobs and taking new jobs and climbing and climbing and climbing until they are at the top. And what started as an honest attempt to keep their family alive and well becomes greed and exploitation of those less privileged than himself. Or like me, one might resort to violence after watching the whole world crumbling around them. There is no such thing as a perfect person. So there's no such thing as a perfect score. In one way or another, we are all complicit in something which ends up hurting others. And if there is a hell, that's where all of us are going. I hope I'm there when Judgment Day comes. Not Watershed, the biblical one. When we meet our oppressors and realize, truly, we are not so different. Every human arrayed in an infinite line, all marched into a room and left to rot as they replay their crimes over and over, repenting and begging for forgiveness wordlessly and never reaching the heavens. If there is a God, maybe they're like Arnold. Maybe we don't deserve their company after all. Huh. I'm not expecting anybody. Do I? I guess I... Hello? Right, one second.
On Asphalt Bones is a strictly fictional podcast distributed free of charge by the Listless Network under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 4.0 international license. This episode was written by
Alex Abrahams,
with audio engineering by Scarlett Foster and Alana Rogers, and was directed by Sivan Raz, with executive producers Alana Rogers and Scarlett. This episode featured performances by
Megan Charlot as the Inquisitor
and me, Will, as the outro. Hi.
For more information, as well as show transcripts and additional content, please check our show notes, follow us on social media at On Asphalt Bones, and check out our website at www.listless.ga. Thank you for listening, and remember,
Baba Booey, Baba Booey, Baba Booey.